Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Life Science Rundown. This is Nicholas Katman with the FDA Group. Before we jump into our discussion for today, just a little bit about the FDA Group. We help life science companies in the areas of quality assurance, regulatory affairs, clinical operations, commissioning, qualification, and validation, as well as CMC. We offer three different engagement models, which are consulting, staff augmentation, and full-time employee recruitment. So if you find yourself in need, just head over to thefdagroup.com to check us out and get in touch. So today I'm speaking with Stephen Poore. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Nicholas. Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
All right. So before we jump into our topic for today, could you just introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. So Stephen Poore. I am a physician scientist. I trained as an ophthalmologist in the UK. I've been in industry for a little over 20 years, and the last 18 years I've been at Novartis. So I've done a number of different roles. I used to head up the ophthalmology retina research team. I've done translational medicine roles. I've done medical affairs roles. Anyway, looking forward to the conversation.
Excellent. Speaking of which, what are we talking about today?
So I wanted to have a sort of an intuitive conversation with you today. And this is really because my organization is shutting down and I've been at Novartis for a very, very long time. And I just want to share some of the experiences and the thought processes as I've gone from realizing that the company was probably going to be getting out of ophthalmology, which I've known since the summer, all the sort of stuff that happened in between, and I'm starting a new job in April. So it's really, I'd say it's about identity in times of change.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the audience either has gone through that or knows somebody that's going through that. And I think one of the things that we're going to bring into the conversation, either toward the middle or the end, is what does 2024 and 2025 look like? I follow an economist organization called ITR Economics. And so some of their reports combined with some of the historical cyclical evidence I've seen about our industry and just kind of what I'm seeing happening, I think will provide some insight into what people can expect coming up in the future. So I think that's a really good and timely conversation.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, let's start there. So one of the things that I think is somewhat shocking is once people find out that they've been in a position at a job in a company for a while, and that is going to come to an end, and either they're in the process of nearing that or it's already transpired. And there's, you know, to your point, kind of this identity shift. And, you know, after, you know, you were at Novartis for over 18 years.
Yeah.
So to go from, you know, my identity is, you know, a Novartis employee and a subject matter expert in ophthalmology. And now that is, you know, going to change. So, you know, how do you look at it?
It's fascinating. There's so many different ways to look at it. I mean, you can go through the classic denial, anger, grief, acceptance, that sort of cycle. And one of the things I just want to share with people as you think about it, one is self-limiting beliefs. And there's a sense that even if you've had a lot of success in your career and people have asked you, you know, hey, why don't you come join our company? Why don't you leave Novartis and do this, that, or the other? And a lot of people can offer things that with the time of major change, your belief in yourself can be severely challenged. And I'd be curious to have conversations with people who go through the same thing. So many mentors or colleagues have said, don't worry, you're going to be fine. You're going to go on doing a great job somewhere else. It's just for me personally that like, oh my God, is this it? Am I never going to have another job again? How am I going to land on my feet? It's just that those feelings of negativity are very real.
Dope.
Even with a ton of success behind it.
Yeah. Yeah. There is definitely that sense of doubt, uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And so in those moments, you know, there's this balance that I think we have to try to overcome, which is there's the rational side, which is, okay, I now need to just go about and look for my next role. But then there's the emotional side, which is how do I, in parallel, deal with some of the kind of upsetting feelings and emotions that I'm going through. So how do you kind of handle those two things?
Gosh. So I think there's two things. One is that as industry professionals, I think we like to-do lists, we like projects, like making out a, okay, how am I going to handle this? And I think when you actually take action like that, it can be quite satisfying and it takes away the fears and you sort of get into role again. But I think that I'd say that dealing with that the negativity, one is to actually put plans together and you start reaching out to contacts, you reach out to companies, you reach out to recruiters. But what I've spent quite a bit of time on is really working on basically where how do I use my brain? What do I focus on? Because if you're going to focus on, oh my God, I'm losing my job and I'm never going to get hired again, or I'm going to go to a terrible job, that's what you keep thinking about. That sort of becomes your reality. So actually back in September, I started using visualizations and I, what's going to happen? Because I knew my job was good probably until Q1 2024. And the mantra that I put in my head is that by this time next year, I'll have an even better job than I do now. And that became something that I just repeated to myself over and over and became like a visualization. So anyway, I'm not sure how many people watching the podcast are into visualization for achieving things, but just like this statement, this is going to happen, actually helped me quite a bit. And by stating that and believing it was going to happen, then it sort of led me down a journey of speaking with many different companies, getting a lot of different advice, and then also being okay with reaching out to people and then not necessarily getting positive feedback. Just this like I have this vision, it's going to happen.
Manifesting, so to speak.
Exactly. Absolutely. And I think it's been very helpful. And I think the other thing is that because the amount of work had decreased, I mean, normally it's, pedal to the metal nonstop. You don't really have time to think. Because of the organization was slowing down, I actually had time to sit and think about these things more.
Now, just to your point about sitting and thinking about things, sometimes that's a good thing, sometimes it's not. And
Indeed.
interestingly enough, if I only reach this far, I can find this book that I read every day. It's called The Daily Stoic. And it's got every day, it just has little things that you can read. So it's just one page a day.
Oh,
And it's
fantastic.
the overall, and it says 366 meditations on wisdom, perseverance, and the art of living. And essentially, so we're in March, so that's how far I am, right? And everything that I've learned in that book thus far is all of the mental anguish we go through is self-inflicted, right? And so the book really tries to educate and train you in when you're going through these challenging times, how do you compartmentalize the negative emotions and say, look, that is a human feeling. It's natural. It's okay. And it's something that I'm allowing to happen to me. And I'm not going to allow my behaviors to be influenced by the emotions that I'm feeling. And so what I need to do is compartmentalize it. And one of the things that I've done, so I remember, I'll give a little anecdote story. So I had hired an IT guy, and he had stolen over $100,000 from the company.
Oh.
Now, so you can imagine the anxiety and embarrassment and shame that I felt in allowing such a thing to happen, right? And one of the things when you're in these moments is you just allow it to kind of eat away at you, or you're always thinking about it. And I forget exactly where I learned this. I want to say maybe Sam Harris, who's a neuropsychologist, but it could have came from somewhere else as well, where essentially you have to, once a thought comes into my head or our heads, you have to determine, is now the appropriate time to think about this? Because sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. So if
Right.
it's 10:24 on a Monday and I'm unemployed and I need to go find another job, it's probably a good time to think about it,
Yeah.
right? But
Right.
if it's 8:24 in the evening and I'm sitting across the table from my wife, probably not the best time for me
Yeah.
to be thinking about it. But that doesn't mean that that thought isn't going to enter my head. So what the kind of the technique is the thought comes in, you recognize it, you say, okay, that thought just entered. I'm making the conscious decision that now isn't the time to be thinking about it. So I'm going to push it away and I'm going to refocus. Now, what I noticed is that that works in the beginning for 10 seconds, right?
Right.
And then it comes back, and then you do it again. And then it works for 30 seconds, and then a minute, and then 10 minutes, and 20 minutes,
Right.
and so on. But it just like anything, whether it's working out, singing, musical instruments, engineering, whatever the case, the more you practice, the better you get. And so, my personal experience is when I notice negative thoughts coming in and compartmentalizing them and saying now's not the appropriate time, they do re-enter, but the gap between the initial entry and the secondary entry is larger now than it was when I first started that practice.
Fascinating. So you've really developed your muscle to compartmentalize negative thoughts, or at least to put them at the time we can deal with them. And did you say that you can't remember how you came up with this system, or was there a learning when was it this guy stealing the 100K that this first came as a technique for you, or how did this come to you?
It definitely wasn't my idea. I know that.
Okay.
Like I said, I think I learned it from a Sam Harris, but I could be
Okay.
wrong.
Interesting.
So I can't remember exactly where I learned the technique.
Okay.
One of the other things I was just thinking about as you were kind of talking about, and I don't want to completely take over the conversation, but I think it's an interesting concept, is the other side of the table, which is the employer. And I can speak to that as the president and CEO of my company. So, in no way, shape, or form is it more difficult on my side as it is the person on the other side. It's not. I have to make a difficult decision, and it's very difficult, and it doesn't compare to the person that just lost their job, right?
Yeah.
But here's one of the things that I've learned about myself very recently is I have not perfected the art of letting people go, and that's something that I need to improve upon. And I just bought a book called The Retention Revolution, and it's not because I want advice on how to retain people. It's because when I was reading the summary, it talks about how to let people go. Now, I've had some very good experiences and some not so good experiences. I'll give you an example of a very good experience I had. So one good experience is we had an employee, and this particular person was in charge of a department, and then we found somebody else and we wanted to bring them in. And we saw value in them. And I've always taken kind of a Bill Belichick type of approach, which is if it's talent, I want it. Even if there's no space on the team, I'll find something for them to do if they're that talented. So
Great
that's what I
philosophy.
did. Well, now all of a sudden you've got two people, kind of similar qualifications, and they're kind of both trying to fit into this box. The person that was originally in that role took on a separate role, but the separate role couldn't justify the pay, right? Because what that person had been brought in for now wasn't what they were doing, and so it couldn't be justified. And we knew that we had to make a change. but it had nothing to do with our financial performance, and it had nothing to do with their individual performance. So what we did was one of our core values is be radically candid. And we said, hey, listen, we're in a difficult position, which is essentially we can't justify your pay, and we're not going to insult you and, slash your pay to kind of bring it to a level that's equitable with the type of work you're doing. But what we're going to do is we're going to ask you to start looking for another job, and we're going to keep you employed until you do.
I love it.
And yeah, and
I
it was
absolutely love
a
it.
yep. And so now here's the very funny thing. So that person left. We stay in contact, and that relationship has held. We actually had another employee come. This employee was interviewing, fascinating person, and they decided to call an ex-employee to ask what it was like to work at the FDA group. They called the person we had let go with that 3 month window, right? And said, hey, you're not there anymore. I want to talk to somebody that doesn't work there now to get their opinion. And that person had really good things to say about us, and that person ended up joining. Okay. So that was a great opportunity where we were in a good position to be able to let them go and maintain that good relationship. Now, what happens when the economy is as such and you have to lay people off? You don't have that flexibility to keep them for 3 months. You don't have that flexibility to give them a wonderful severance agreement like they might have expected. The other thing is we live in a very litigious society. And so you have to be, these conversations are only 2 minutes and then you have to get off. And it's because we have to act prudently in these conversations. I am looking for more information so that when these types of situations happen, how am I able to get through those and then still maintain a good relationship with the person that exited? And I don't have that answer yet.
It's a fascinating question because I think the amount of humanity that you showed in the case that you were describing earlier, I mean, it's how I would want to be treated. And I think it shows a lot of just emotional intelligence. And at least you found like a win-win thing, honesty, explaining the situation, humanity, here's your time, here's the money, go find another job. I'm sure you gave a fantastic reference for this person, and I'm going to bet they landed a great job. Did they land a great job? Not a surprise at all. But the other situation where it's like, oh man, the economy is tanking. We are in a mess. And I would love to see as you read through the retention revolution, right? Who's the author?
I don't know. I just bought it either this weekend or Friday. And I have not started reading it, but like I said, when I read probably 2 books a quarter.
Oh, that's funny. I was just going to ask you, how many books do you read a year?
Yeah, so that's what do the math, two, four, six, six books a
Six.
year. So the author is Erica Keswin. And so when I'm ending a book, I usually look for a couple three things when I'm looking. One is I like new content. So one of the very famous business books is Good to Great by Jim Collins, and I've read that book. Well, unfortunately for me, I read it a little too late, and he talked about how great Fannie Mae and Radio Shack are. And
Well, you can't always be
yeah,
right.
right. And so, and but the content was still good. The content was great. So don't get me wrong. But I do like good content. I also like fantastic books, meaning it might be some content that might not be really applicable to me in my business world now, but it's so transformational that I just have to read it. And that's really good stuff too. And then the third thing, which is why I got this, is I found a gap in my professional, curriculum. And that is one that I've discovered is that when moments occur where I don't have the opportunity to offer grace, how am I able to let somebody go in that type of circumstance and not end that personal relationship?
Please, when you figure out the formula, I would love to know.
I want to know. I need to find out.
Can I actually visit? Because there's kind of an obvious question there. So, what are the most informative books for your career that you've read, and what are the books that you would recommend, say, for myself or for anyone else there, that you think that really has provided a great insight or moved the needle for your career?
Radical Candor by Kim Scott. Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink.
Extreme ownership.
Those are my two favorites. Actually, I'll have a little polite plug. I'm coming out. I wrote a book, and it's going to launch next quarter called The Passionate Workforce. So that book is essentially. We were going to call the book The Passionate Workforce Spectrum, but the publisher said it was too long. So it's just called The Passionate Workforce. But essentially, we've all been on a spectrum. And at one point or another, you and I, Stephen, we've both been passionate about a job. And when we are, we exert certain behaviors. We show up on time, we care about the quality of our work. We're innovative and creative. We do the little extras. We're helpful. Da, 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 da. Same person, and we've also been resentful. Same person, different behaviors. We don't show up on time. We don't care about the quality of our work. We're not innovative and creative. We can be destructive, so on and so forth. And in fact, there was this example. And this is just somebody that had come and presented to one of my CEO advisory groups, and he talked about this gentleman, and he worked at a hotel chain, and he worked at one hotel chain, and he worked at two hotel chains at the exact same time, and had completely different behaviors when he was at one hotel chain versus the other because of the leadership and the management. In one, he was resentful, and in one, he was very passionate, right? So in my opinion, if we as leaders and managers can get the people that report to us in a passionate mindset, we can expect them to exert certain behaviors. And I would describe those behaviors as optimized performance. So if we can get them to optimize their performance, and we're in a pretty good situation. And so I have 15 pillars. I have an assessment tool. It's a pretty easy read. One of the things I like about the book, which is not a compliment to me, it's a compliment to the publisher, there's no fat. So if you've ever read a book and you say, wow, we're still talking about this, that's not my book. We get in, we explain it, and then we move on. So just a polite plug there. But those are kind of the two books that kind of have framed kind of how I look at my professional career.
Excellent. I'm very much looking forward to reading them, and I really want to know about these 15 pillars. So I will force myself to be patient, but I will be one of the early purchasers. So very much looking forward to it.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, do you have any books that resonated with you?
Yeah, so honestly, I've been reading a lot of books. So one of the things I've done in my time off is like taking up a speed reading course.
Oh.
And one of the other things of one of my online mentors is to schedule time every day for learning. So you have all your appointments, and so I'm going to do this as I do it now because I've had more time at work. But when I get to the new job and things are crazy, I'm still going to schedule at least a half hour every day where I sit and read. And with the speed reading, you can go through a lot more stuff. So I don't think I have any that are quite as transformational or as critical as the two that you described. But like, for example, at the moment, I'm reading a lot of stuff about how to optimize the brain, how to get into focus and mindset. And kind of going back, that's why I thought it was so interesting when you talked about the passionate mindset, because I've read so much about like, so like there's a question, I guess, which is on a score from 0 to 10, where 10 is you are so engaged in your job. I am like, I am going to do absolutely everything I can. And 0 is I could not give a damn. And, you know, it's like, how many people are 10? And if you could, you know, if you can be a 10 yourself and just move your team to do stuff, you know, how do you raise the people to that level? And I just think this sort of concept is fascinating, because as I'm realizing with the mindset of, you know, I'm going to have a great job, it's like, I'm going to have huge success at work. I'm going to bring drugs to market. I'm going to transform whatever. It's like, you know, can you really live that, and can you imbue it into your team? So anyway, this is kind of what I'm really interested to see if I can deliver on this. And so getting more books, getting more techniques, I'm all in. I want to learn more.
One of the things I wanted to talk about too is just kind of what there is to look forward to in 2024 and 2025. But before we jumped in there, was there anything else that you thought was worthwhile uncovering as it pertains to the audience and, you know, what a lot of people are going through in terms of this transition, identity, and so on and so forth? I know I kind of hijacked the conversation for a little while there, but I wanted to revisit that.
Yeah, I'm getting back. But first of all, I want to say thank you. You shared so many interesting topics. I guess the one thing I can just say is thinking from multiple angles. It's like I've probably tried maybe 15 different approaches over the time frame, and it's like I didn't settle for the first job that came to me. It's like speaking to I drew out a large plan of all my different options, and I think that gave me a sense of control and very much helped kill the negative thinking. So just, I guess, just a small tidbit just to share from my personal experience.
Great. Well, let me speak to what I'm seeing for 2024 and 2025. So there's, and this is my own opinion for the most part, and my own kind of terminology. So it's you know, it's not fact, it's opinion. But I'll kind of give some information as to why I believe what I believe. So we just went through all the layoffs, right? And when companies go through layoffs, they do it in sweeping fashion, right? It's not every week, okay, these four, next week, these three, next week, those five, right? They come in, it's all planned out. We're doing 1,000. 10,000, 500, whatever the case may be, right? And you try to do it once, rip that band-aid off, and then that's enough, right? You don't want to keep doing ripping open the band-aid over and over again, right? And that's why it's kind of one big sweep. So generally what happens is after about 3 to 6 months, you never get it perfect. And so after about 3 to 6 months, you find out where you cut a little too thin. Okay. And where you cut a little too thin, that's when the companies start saying, okay, we cut a little too thin here. We need to bring some people in. Oftentimes, I would say it's more frequent that you see contractors and consultants because you just let go of full-time employees and, you know, you kind of bring in those people to kind of fill in those gaps. But over a period of time, you might say, okay, it's justified. Things have changed, economies, new products, whatever the case may be, assuming you're not going out of business, now we can kind of rehire, replenish this department. So we've just started the rebound. And when I say just started, I want people to envision the beginning of the bell curve. So that means some people might say, yeah, I've kind of seen a little bit. Other people saying, Nick, I have no idea what you're talking about. I haven't seen anything, right? And because the beginning of the bell curve is very, very small, right? But soon we'll get to the bigger part of the bell curve. So my prediction is that going into the summer and the fall is where you're going to see the kind of the top of that bell curve in terms of the rebound and in terms of companies bringing people back in, either on a contract or a permanent basis. Now, we're in an election year, and generally speaking, things are improved from an economic standpoint following an election year. There's just a little bit more awareness or enthusiasm about what the, administration's going to bring, whether it's a continuation of the previous administration or a new administration. So that is a possibility. ITR Economics expects that 2025 is going to be a boom.
Interesting. Wow. Okay.
So what that means is, in order for 2025 to be a boom, it has to start in 2024. So if I were to paint a picture in people's minds, the rebound has started now. We're in March. It'll go up until the summer or the fall. And then as you start to go down the downslope of the bell curve, I think we as an economy, a marketplace, et cetera, will be caught by the increase in the economy. And so we're not going to see that downslope because the economy is going to replace the rebound, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I think for everybody, and we're all individuals, individual companies, so on and so forth, but I think we all have been very much impacted by the macro economy, and we can see how much it impacts our daily lives, whether it's from a personal or professional standpoint. And so I think going into late 2024, 2025, and 2026, it's going to be very good.
Okay. It's so you're feeling optimism at the moment?
Does it sound that way?
I'm going to say so. I'm reading between the lines. I see a smile. I can see just, the gray matter worrying a little bit as you think out your plans for, how do you take advantage of this? Now, for the FDA group, are you going to be taking on more people or expanding? What's your thoughts about how are you going to catch the wave from the expected good times coming?
Very interesting. So we're actually looking at purchasing some companies right now.
Oh, okay. Have you purchased companies before? Is this going to be a first time activity
This will
or?
be the first time for me.
Interesting.
So
Wow.
I've been to a lot of seminars, read a lot of books, heard a lot of presentations, so on and so forth. But I've been in this, I would say, M&A space pretty heavily for the past couple of years. And so it's a really opportune time for us to bring in some companies that would help kind of bring scale to the organization or complement what we're doing. And then I think that would prime us so that once there's a kind of a resurgence in work, we're going to be prepped to be able to handle that work.
That's fascinating. I'm just thinking, so I've done a lot of work with BD&L, but it's always been the context of big pharma and just giving scientific input. To me, the idea of like saying, okay, I have my company, I'm actually going to learn how to acquire another company and do it. That's like such a big task. I'm just trying to think, like, how did you wake up and say, hey, this is what I'm going to do?
From an M&A standpoint,
Just it's like a skill set, right?
Well, I've been doing this for 17 years, and what happens in business prior to any M&A activity is companies hit plateaus, and I am not immune to plateaus, just like every other business. And so there's these natural plateaus that every company hits. And so me and my executive team, we kind of said, we're ready to move out of our mother's basement. And we're ready to, really be aggressive and expand, because we're, now this is going to sound like a pitch, which I really try not to do. But the conversation's kind of moving in this path, so I'll keep going. We're really excited about the culture we've created here, and there's evidence to it. Whether it's our Great Place to Work certification, A plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, 4.8 out of 5-star rating on Glassdoor.com. We have our 95% right place, right person first time placement, 97%. client satisfaction rating. I could go on and on, but we have lots of data and metrics that prove that what we say is true. And it's all backed by a total quality guarantee. We're the only consulting firm, and I've been saying this for years, and I've yet to be corrected, that offers a total quality guarantee. So we're very confident in what we're doing and our ability to deliver. That combined with the fact that we utilize something called EOS, which is the Entrepreneurial Operating System. Essentially, it's something that allows you to create a structure for your company where you can scale. And so when you have the right culture and business practices and structure in order to scale, that's what really gets you excited about the ability to kind of take that leap. And so that was kind of the driving factor.
I love, I mean, basically, you're describing this to me. It's like, hey, I want a piece of that for my company. I want a piece of that for my next organization that I go into. And it's like, that's the kind of culture I want to be in. So is the 15 pillars going to get me there?
It should, yeah.
Okay, I love it.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. So the company that I partnered with in order to write the book, I don't know if you've ever heard of David Goggins.
Yes, yes,
Yeah, so
yes,
it's
yes,
the
yes. He's
same
Scottish.
company that did his book,
Oh, wow.
Can't Hurt Me. So, they actually give you a book when you sign up on how to write books. So it's
Oh,
kind of
okay.
funny. And I read that too. And they talk about a lot of the emotional things that goes through you when you're like learning about how to write a book. And they said, you're going to hate it. You're going to hate your book. You're going to sabotage yourself. You're not going to want to publish it. And, you know, these are all natural things that you're going to feel and you're going to go through and just be prepared for it. But, you know, don't fall into that trap, you know, and so on and so forth. And you know, politely speaking, I didn't feel those emotions.
Interesting. So you didn't have any self-limiting beliefs, any self-sabotage, and
I no, I really, because any pretty much every book is based off of information that they've gathered from other people, right? And so they've heard information from other people, they've brought that in, and they've created their own spin on that information that they've gathered. So, and I'm no different. I've read lots and lots of books, learned a lot of information, and I've gotten to a point where I feel like I can take all of these disparate books and trainings, and I could compile them into a methodology that is simple that people can use in order to achieve that outcome that's really the goal of the book. Now, as it pertains to books, there's two types of books, in my opinion. There's transformational books, and then there's easy reading, get a gold nugget book. Okay. A transformational book would be like Traction from Gino Wickman or Money Master the Game by Tony Robbins. You can't listen to that book on the treadmill. You can't read that book without a highlighter. Okay. It requires your attention. You need to take notes. You need to implement, so on and so forth. But then there's other books like the ones that I referenced earlier in the podcast, where you can run on the treadmill and get interrupted for 30 seconds, come back, and you really didn't miss a whole lot. You can just kind of keep going, right? And that's really what I wanted. Now, the only thing that my l listeners or readers would need to do is just take the assessment, have the assessment ready, and write down the 15 pillars. That's it. As long as you can just write down the 15 pillars and have the assessment, that's all you need to do. Everything else, you can just kind of listen and you can do it in the car, you can do it in line, you can do it while you're getting ready in the morning, whatever the case may be.
So what I love about this, I think it's like a great lesson where, I mean, you've taken your 17 years, you've assimilated this massive information, and once you've put all the work and effort in, then it's reduced to something relatively simple. But that's that you can only do that at like the highest level of mastery, at least my perspective. And I think that's the great joy and thank you for these different books, which I'm now with the speed reading dedicated to time. I've realized that I actually have the ability to read a lot more than I thought possible before. So I'm really looking forward to getting in. But like just that, you know, you read a book and someone has put 10 years or longer into this concept and then you get it. It's like, man, it just enriches life so much.
Yeah.
So really excited, really looking forward to reading the 15 pillars. I mean, I know it's anyway, just at least get the concepts. That's gonna be exciting.
Yeah, it's really cool. And the other thing is when you write a book, was it Roosevelt that said or was it Abraham Lincoln? I would have written you a shorter letter, but I didn't
I know
have
that
the
is.
time. Yeah.
It's Mark Twain.
Well, oh, it's Mark Twain. Okay. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
that's the one.
Yeah. Okay. So when we wrote the first manuscript, it was X long, and then the editors come in.
Yeah.
And they start slashing, you know, and they take out all the fat, you know. And that part's a little painful.
Yeah,
You know,
they're
because
like,
you're
hey,
like,
you took that bit out? What do you mean? That was awesome. It was
yeah,
gold.
yeah. But it's all justified, you know, and you're like, all right, I get it. But then when you kind of read the fully edited manuscript, you can see how smooth it is. And, you know, they're experts in their field. And I'll give them a shout out. So the company that helped me is Scribe. So just for anybody that's listening that ever thought of writing a book, I highly recommend them. They were excellent. Like I said, they did David Goggins' book. There's some other very famous authors that they worked with. And it was a really, really wonderful experience. And I'm really looking forward to the launch. It's been a long time coming. I actually probably could launch sooner, but I decided not to because I want to come out with the Audible version.
Oh, good.
And yeah, and
are you reading it? Are you gonna read
absolutely
it?
not. I'm too nasally.
Oh,
so
that's right.
but there was a book I was really interested in reading, listening to, because I'm an auditory learner, so everything I do is audible.
Yeah.
And they launched the book and I said, oh great, I want that book. But then when I went to get the Audible, only the hard and soft cover were available. By the time they came out with the Audible, I lost my interest. And when you come out with a new book, everybody's really ready and anxious, you know? And so I don't want to, you know, come out too soon and then not have, you know, the Audible version and then lose that, you know, those people that are really interested in the content, but then lose their enthusiasm like I did. So I'm just going to hold off a little bit more until that's complete and then come out.
Okay, you're going to leave your fans, you know, in suspense a little bit. It's like when we're waiting for the Harry Potter book to come out.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, yeah.
Kind of.
And it's funny because people ask about it pretty often, which is like a humbling experience, you know, because who am you know, I'm everybody else, right? Who am I?
Yeah.
You know, who am I to write a book? Who am I to think that I have something to offer? Who am I to think that somebody would spend their hard-earned dollars on something that I've written? But at the same time, I'll say who I am. I am somebody that has learned from a lot of really intelligent people and found bits and pieces that I think are very useful. And over time, just by osmosis, it kind of naturally formed into these 15 pillars. And it was just one day I said, well, hold on a second. This is what I'm using. This is a methodology I'm using in my company. And it was based off of everything else that I had learned.
Yeah.
It's probably not a bad time to say, hey, everybody, I've read all of this stuff. And it just so happens that it created this methodology that I use in my company. And I have data to prove that the methodology works. Why not share it with everybody else? And so that's why I feel comfortable sharing it.
Fantastic. Maybe as you said that you didn't have any of the the very common, like, oh, my book sucks. No one's going to want to read this. Why am I doing this?
And I think that's kind of what they were alluding to, is some people might say that what I just said, which is, who am I? You know, why do I think that I'm deserving of people's time and attention? And am I a fraud? Am I, you know, and so on and so forth. And so I think because a lot of these ideas are based off of people much more intelligent than me, and it just so happened that I was able to kind of take all these ingredients, throw them into a bowl, and it produced a cake. I might as well show everybody, all those different ingredients so they can make their own cake.
I love it. It's kind of funny. I know we're nearly at time, but again, there's like these two things. One is like intuition, and the other one is purpose. And then it's like, well, how does this line up with what you want to achieve? And then there's like courage as well. It's like, you know what? It's like, hey, I'm going to produce a piece of art. I'm going to produce a song or whatever. You put it out there and see what people think. And then it's like, okay, I had a lot of energy that went into this. Are people going to love it? They're going to hate it. And then you just got to like put it out there, and it's like,
Yep. We'll see what
let it roll,
happens.
see what happens.
Yeah. Well, this is and for everybody that's listened this far, Stephen and I had something completely different to talk about today, and we did a complete 180. So hopefully everybody enjoyed this podcast and was able to get something out of it. Before we wrap up, Stephen, was there anything you wanted to leave the audience with?
Think positively. It's just funny. It's just really simple. You just What you think about is what happens, and that's gonna be kind of my learning experience from the last 9 months. And it's life is more enjoyable that way.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, well, Stephen, I really appreciate the time. Thank you for joining. And to everybody listening, as always, if you find conversations like this valuable, please share it with a colleague or your professional network. If you have not already, subscribe to get updates of new episodes at theftagroup.com/podcast and follow the FDA Group on LinkedIn. If you'd like to connect about project or resource needs, head over to theftagroup.com to get in touch, or feel free to connect with me personally on LinkedIn. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see y'all next time.
All right. So Nicholas, thank you so much. That was fun.